This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we remember Paul Tsongas. The former senator from Massachusetts died Saturday at the age of 55. He had pneumonia and a liver problem related to his treatments for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a slow-growing cancer of the lymph system. In 1984, he left the Senate because of cancer. He had a bone marrow transplant in 1986 that appeared to leave him cancer-free. Last May, he had another transplant to correct a bone marrow disorder that can occur in people who have recovered from lymph cancer. His medical history was an issue when he ran for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1992. In the campaign, he was also criticized for a lack of charisma, but I thought he showed a good sense of humor and irony about himself and American politics when we spoke later that year after he dropped out of the race. Tell me why you wanted to be president. I think it's actually difficult for a lot of people to understand why someone would want to be president. Yes, there's the kind of power of it and everything, but there's so many headaches involved with the office, and there are so many seemingly unsolvable problems that are laid at the president's feet. Why did you want the job? And I mean, you've been in politics long enough to know about the kind of frustrations that you have campaigning for such a job.
I said during the campaign that I felt an obligation of my survival. When I left Washington in 1984, I never thought that I would come back into politics at any level, let alone run for president. But I've been out in the private side. I see what's happening to this country in terms of its economy. And I know what the implications of that are long term. And so I felt strongly that I knew where we had to go. I wrote the book, A Call to Economic Arms. And my thought at that point was to do a book tour, to endorse somebody else, run in New Hampshire, or run across the country. So that's where it came from. If you remember, when I got into this thing, George Bush was at 91%. I was dismissed as a serious candidate. I was Greek. I was from Massachusetts. I've had cancer. I have no office, etc. But I believed passionately in the ideas and strategies that were in my book. And my feeling was, as my wife said, that we have an obligation to the world our children are going to live in. And we felt that very strongly. So when I announced my candidacy, I had never lost an election, and I was very proud of what I had done. And I knew damn well that when I got into this thing that there would be a level of ridicule. But it didn't bother me because I felt that for whatever reason that I had survived my cancer and that I felt that obligation, and therefore the running, in essence, this sense of obligation insulated me from worrying about what people thought. And I think, obviously, I've changed the debate in the Democratic Party, and I feel fulfilled.
Do you feel that you succumbed to any campaigning pressures and ended up doing things that you didn't really want to do, but you knew you had to do to stay viable?
I guess the one thing that I have a sense that I gave into was a schedule that was inhuman. The fact is that we were so concerned about the media's focus on my stamina, which was a nonsense issue, but they were so focused on it, that we simply ran a schedule that would pour me into the streets and engage in activity at a pace that was simply not sustainable, particularly someone like me who has a need for 8 hours sleep a night. You're running on 5-6 hours, and eventually you pay a price for that. I remember during the end, I would be giving speeches and would almost wake up in the middle of them. I'm not sure my audience did, but to give you a metaphor, analogy, everyone's driven down a highway and your mind kind of slips into other thinking, you sort of snap 2 or 3 miles down the road and wonder how you got there. Well, that was happening to me during the campaign. I'd be in the middle of a speech and sort of wake up 10 minutes later in the speech and wonder, God, I hope I stuck to what I was supposed to talk about. And that was a function of being tired, and we gave in. We gave in to the pressure to have that kind of a schedule, and if I ever do it again, I would not repeat that mistake.
Well, I remember seeing all the pictures of you in your swim trunks the day that the press came to watch you swim, which was also an attempt to prove that you were, you know, really healthy and energetic. What was that like for you that day? Was there anything embarrassing about having to, you know, like, strip to your trunks and swim in front of, you know, the national press?
Well, you know, I've competed now for 3 years in my
true,
Speedo bathing
right.
suit, so
right.
I'm used to that. You know, it's funny because my focus at that point was, I'm 51, so you know, I don't have the body I had when I swam in college. And I'm so used to mentally thinking of myself in the photographs of the Dartmouth swimming team that when I would see myself in the photographs that were in the paper, I would lament my aging process. But other than that, the only concern I actually had was how well I would swim. If you remember, the ad we ran in the campaign was an ad of me doing the butterfly, which won an award as the best ad of the campaign. And that, it's interesting because we did that very purposefully. It was a way of not only making the argument about swimming against the tide, which was the kind of theme of the campaign, but by using a stroke like the butterfly, which the vast majority of people cannot do, it was a way of saying to people, look, he can swim the butterfly, you can't, so stop worrying about his health. And so it was a very purposeful attempt to say, you can make your own judgments, just look at him. What was interesting during the campaign was that people would come up to me and say, I saw your butterfly ad, I thought it was wonderful. Who did the swimming?
They thought you had a stunt double?
That's what they thought. It was, and I would tell them, I did it. And they would look at you like, well, okay, I hear you, and I'm supposed to believe you, but I really don't.
Huh. Now, how does an idea like this come up? Not the campaign ad, but the idea of swimming for the national press. How did that come up in the campaign? What was the process of conversation like in deciding whether you should do it or not?
Well, there was never, what happened was that I had intended, no matter the fact that I was running, that I would compete in the nationals. I had competed last year in the YMCA nationals, and this year had signed up for both the Y Nationals and the Masters Nationals, which is the highest level of competition in master swimming. And so I had intended, irrespective of the campaign, to swim in that those competitions. So I would try to schedule during the day, maybe 3 days a week, a workout. So it wasn't that these were staged for the media, but rather they were on my schedule anyway, and I did it constantly. But there was one day when I was finally a serious candidate that I forget now where I was. All these pools began to fuse together in my mind. But there were 36 cameras when I went to work out between still photographers and the TV cameras. And what's interesting about it is you cannot do a normal workout with that kind of attention, because what you do is you swim faster than you would normally, and you simply get out of your rhythm and you exhaust yourself. So when I was swimming, I realized I was swimming too fast, but I didn't have the courage to slow down because I thought I would look like a very average swimmer when the people turned on the television sets and saw me. So, and I would do a lot more butterfly and a lot less freestyle, and at the end, I would go back into the locker room and say, you fool. But I would do the same thing the next time.
We'll get back to our 1992 interview with Paul Tsongas after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to a 1992 interview with Paul Tsongas, former senator from Massachusetts. He died last Saturday. We spoke after he dropped out of the Democratic presidential primary in 1992. During his campaign, the issue he emphasized was the economy, one of the most complex issues to get across. I asked him about the obstacles he faced in talking meaningfully about the economy.
Well, I think the obstacles were really no different than perhaps you find in any democratic society. I gave a speech the other day to a journalism class, and I said, I went over and picked up a newspaper, and I said, put yourself in this situation. The headline of the story on the front page is, Tsongas articulates position on world population link to economic development. See page 15. I said, how many of you would really be interested in turning to page 15? Then I said, imagine a second story. Tsongas regrets having had Hiram in the 1980s. Turn to page 15. Well, I mean, it's obvious. And the question is, how do you break through that in a situation? What we ended up relying upon, surprisingly, was my book. That the demand for the book was so extraordinary, and that's where a lot of our volunteers came from, that people were ready to absorb 83 pages of our policy. But the problem was getting that through the mass media. And that's why I think the use of the Larry Kings, the use of talk programs, etc., is really very valuable, because it, rather than a 9-second, which is now the average soundbite on the nightly news, you have a capacity to articulate things in some depth. And I will tell you that one of the great changes in American politics is C-SPAN. I would invariably run into people who would come up to me and know my issues in some detail and who were supporters who had become, in essence, C-SPAN junkies, not unlike what your network does in trying to do things in some depth. And that's, I think, where people end up having a sense of the issues.
One of the things you were up against with the press in your campaign was that people referred to you as the anti-charisma candidate. And, I mean, in a Newsweek voter's guide, it described you as having a dweebish TV presence, and it said this would make it hard to rally the country with speeches. Reading all this charisma stuff reminded me of the comic Washington, the Mark Allen Stamety comic strip about Washington, where his Senator Bob Forehead has a charismatician who's, I mean, this is the most shallow candidate in the world, you know, and the job of the charismatician, of course, is to just kind of give him lots of charisma. How important do you think charisma should be in a voter's decision to elect somebody?
Well, I don't think it can be dismissed. There is charisma and there is charisma. I think ideas have real power. And no one ever accused me. I used to say that when I would introduce my wife, that I did not have charisma, but I had enough sense to marry it. And she was someone who could really, on a television set, just project. And I don't know where you get it, and if I could go and buy it, I would. But the fact is that Nikki was able to do that. I've never been able to do that. So I have to rely upon the soundness of my ideas and people's perceiving my commitment to these ideas. So I think you can lead people. I mean, look at Ross Perot. I find it intriguing watching Ross Perot. And they used to accuse me of being too short. I think I'm 3 inches taller than he is. That I was non-charismatic in terms of my telegenic qualities. Well, if I was non-charismatic, I don't know what you say about him, but he has a charisma based on people's perception that this guy will go in there and do what's necessary. So it may not be the kind of Robert Redford in The Candidate kind of charisma, but I think ideas do have power, particularly at a time when people are scared stiff about where their country is going. And there's no doubt in my mind that that is what Ross Perot is tied into.
What kind of critique sessions would you do of yourself on television so that you could, you know, project better? Was that a regular part of the campaigning process?
Well, it wasn't in the beginning. I was pretty stubborn about things and said, look, I'm into this. Seems absurd in the retelling. I'm into this campaign because of issues. I'm not going to be handled, that kind of thing. And then one day, excuse me, my wife made the point that she said, look, Paul, you're really being a fool here. The fact is we got into this race to get these ideas articulated, and all the press is talking about is your lack of telegenic capabilities. So why don't you acknowledge that and overcome it so people will listen to what you're talking about? And we reached out to a woman, Joyce Tsongas, who was married previously to my cousin in Portland, Oregon, and she came and we began that process. And I must say, I regret having been so mulish in the beginning, because by the time she had worked with us and I did the later TV debates, we did quite well.
What's the first thing you would change about the campaign process if you had the power to change it?
It's interesting. I get that question all the time. And people, I think, presume that since I lost, that I would feel very strongly that the system is wrong, that the definition of a system is one you can win. But I must say, I really would not change it. I think there have been some major changes in terms of the most important reform was matching funds. The federal government matching contributions up to $250. That is what kept us alive. And I think if nothing else, that is going to give people who are outsiders, who are ideas people, who don't who are not taking PAC money the opportunity to compete. The only change that I really call for is with the press, that when somebody like me comes along in the future who holds no office, who is not taking PAC money, who has very limited capacity to raise money, don't write us off. Give us the same chance you give someone who holds office. If I had not gotten sick, been elected to the Senate reelected in 1984, and then reelected in 1990, and run for president, I would not have been treated the way I had been. So the presumption was that having gone through the battle with cancer, having been in the private sector, made me a lesser person, a lesser qualified, if you will, to be president than if I had stayed in Washington and served in the Senate. That is absurd. So my comment to the press was, if people come along, give them a chance and let them disprove their capabilities. Don't presume them.
You were the first presidential candidate to have had cancer. Health was an issue, but you seemed to really be able to more or less put that behind you. But after you dropped out of the race, it was revealed that you had a node with cancerous cells as late as 1987, which was a year after your experimental treatment. And some doctors said that that was actually very significant because it showed the bone marrow transplant that you had didn't cure you. And that raised the question, why wasn't this information brought up sooner?
Well, what happened was that that information was no secret. When it happened, the reporters here in Boston of the Boston Globe were aware of it. And at the time, it didn't mean a heck of a lot to us because over time, there was no indication of cancer, number one. Secondly, there was an article in the Boston Magazine that specifically talked about the node and the fact that it was cancerous. So this was an open issue. During the campaign, I told a reporter from the Washington Post about the node. What had happened was that I've been through so many experiences after the bone marrow transplant with things that are frightening and potentially serious. When you do a CAT scan, things show up and you do them 3 days later, they're not there again, those kinds of things. So the node was viewed as a happenstance, and my doctor told me 3 or 4 years ago, we're not sure what it means. So in the process of trying to deal with survival, you simply don't focus on these things and let them dominate your thinking. Now, what had happened was I had mentioned that to a couple of reporters, but the doctors did not mention it to the New York Times reporter when he did the feature story on my health, and they should have. But it wasn't viewed by them to be that significant, and the fact is if we were trying to keep it secret, the last thing I would have done was to tell the Washington Post about the node. But I think the press legitimately felt that, however we may have felt about the node, that my doctors, et cetera, that that should have been referred to more prominently than it was. So in retrospect, I think it's clear that a mistake was made, and to be able to say, well, we told other reporters, really doesn't give the New York Times reporter any comfort.
How public do you think a candidate's medical record should be?
Well, I think normally they should be private, but in the case of someone like me who's had cancer, I think they have the right to access. I don't like it. And what I've done is I've asked Dana-Farber, and they did it on their own, to duplicate all of my records and to seal them and send them to me. So I now have that, and I said if I ever were to surface again on the national political scene, those records would be available to the press and to other physicians and let them decide what they wish to decide. And that's a heck of a precedent to set, and I do it with great reluctance, but I think in my case, I have no choice.
The experimental treatment that you went through for cancer was, I know, very painful. Part of the
It was not painful.
Well, no, here's what I'm thinking of. When you had to get your bone drilled to see if the treatment was appropriate, you had to get your bone drilled and marrow taken out to see if the cancer had spread. And that sounded like a really, really miserable process. The anesthetic does not apparently affect the bone pain. How did you deal with the pain?
Well, the first couple of times I went through that, I spent my time commiserating with myself and feeling sorry for myself. And it's about 20 minutes, a half an hour, and it's very painful. But one day I figured out while I was lying there that, you know, there are a lot of people, thousands of people, have been tortured. And the fact is they don't undergo 20 minutes of pain. They undergo hours of pain. The people who are inflicting it upon them are not friends who really care for you and physicians, but they are tormentors, and they don't get out. You're going to, a half an hour from now, you're going to be out. You're going to get back in your car and drive home to a family that cares for you. So what the hell are you complaining about? And once you look at it in that perspective, it seems very endurable.
Paul Tsongas, recorded in 1992. He died Saturday at the age of 55. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.